welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. It is July 1st, and after over a year of COVID restrictions, most of them will be ending today. Many New Mexicans will be celebrating. However, the pandemic is not over yet. 31% of New Mexico's population still hasn't been fully vaccinated. And the WHO recently released a statement urging continued use of masks, even for fully vaccinated folks, in order to protect from the COVID-19 Delta variant. On this week's Let's Talk New Mexico, we are discussing what reopening means for our state. And we want to hear from you. Are you excited to see these restrictions being lifted? Or do you have concerns that it might be too much too soon? Email us at letstalk@kunm.org or call in live at 505-277-5866. My first guest is Nora Sacken, Press Secretary for Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham. Good morning, Nora. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. So what exactly is changing today?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's an exciting day. New Mexicans have worked really hard for this day, and the governor is really appreciative of everybody's sacrifice and everybody's commitment to safety throughout this time, and people should be excited about what we've achieved. Mm-hmm. And so today what we're looking at is pandemic-related occupancy restrictions on, you know, any form of commercial activity are lifted as of today. So we're operating without the color-coded county-by-county system. That mm-hmm. framework is gone. So we're past turquoise now. Businesses can operate at 100% of capacity mm-hmm. if they choose to. And limits on mass gatherings are also gone.
And what about mask rules? What is changing in regards to those?
Yeah, so the state is continuing to follow CDC guidance with respect to face covering, so as we have been doing for a while now. So masks are, you know, per CDC guidance, still required for anyone who is unvaccinated. Mm-hmm. Also importantly, you know, any business or workplace or sovereign nation is able to continue to require masks for employees or mm-hmm. customers or visitors, regardless of their vaccination status, at their discretion.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because, of course, COVID-19 has hit many of our native communities particularly hard. So as you say, they will still be able to enforce their own restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's you know, definitely something really important for New Mexicans to consider, especially as we're out you know, recreating on our beautiful lands in New Mexico that we have this summer. You know, be aware that our, like you said, New Mexico's sovereign nations were hit particularly hard by the pandemic. And so many of them, you know, they are sovereign nations. They are able to enforce any sort of rules that they should choose. And any person visiting visiting a pueblo or a tribe, visiting that land to enjoy some outdoor recreation should be mindful of that and should mm-hmm. respect that.
Okay. We have our first question. It is an email from Leslie Kay. She says that she is apprehensive because the pandemic is not over and cases are rising in various parts of the world and country. She's worried that New Mexico may see another spike by the end of summer. Her question is, if cases rise again, what's the plan? What will trigger reimposition of restrictions?
So one thing to definitely highlight is our vaccination rate. You know, over 70% of eligible New Mexicans have at least one dose, which mm-hmm. is great. And we're going to keep pushing for all of them to get their second dose. We have over 62% of New Mexicans that have completed their vaccination series, and that's a really great number and one that New Mexicans should be proud of. And we want to say thank you to everybody who has gotten vaccinated to protect mm-hmm. themselves and protect their loved ones and protect their community, and that's really how we're going to keep moving forward. So, you know, it's important that we continue to encourage folks to get vaccinated, you know, especially our 12-year-olds and up, 12 to 16, are eligible for Pfizer, mm-hmm. and they became eligible a little later in the game, so we have some room to make up for there, and we want to make sure we're getting kiddos vaccinated as well to protect them. You know, moving forward, we know the risks. That's certainly mm-hmm. true. There are variants spreading. we do have to trust people to make the right decisions for themselves, and that's why we're going to keep encouraging folks to get vaccinated to protect themselves and their communities. And we're going to keep an eye on the horizon. We're going to keep following the science, and our public health order that went into effect today does continue to abide by CDC guidance. So if that guidance changes, you know, we will come, we will revisit it and readdress that.
So it's tied to the CDC's guidelines, and we'll, if folks watch what the CDC is saying, they'll have some idea of what might happen in New Mexico?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Okay. So on June 26th, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the World Health Organization released a statement urging continued usage of masks, even by fully vaccinated folks, due to the highly contagious Delta 9 variant of COVID. Health officials in Los Angeles County this week strongly recommended that people wear masks indoors in public places, regardless of their vaccination status, to prevent the spread of this Delta variant. Is there a reason why our state is not following this same advice from the WHO?
So as I mentioned, you know, our state public health order is following CDC guidance. We have been following CDC guidance for a while now, including on requiring face masks. So we're going to continue to do that, and we're going to pay close attention to what the CDC is recommending. Certainly it's the case that, you know, countries across the world and states across the U.S. are seeing more occasions of the Delta variant. As of Monday, my understanding is New Mexico has recorded 30 cases of the Delta variant. So we're still pretty low, especially comparatively. So that's good news. And, you know, the main thing is to make sure that folks get vaccinated. And so that's really going to continue to be our focus, even as we reopen, even as we celebrate all the hard work everybody has done. We're going to continue pushing for folks to get vaccinated.
Sure. And as you said, the CDC is recommending that folks who are unvaccinated continue to wear masks. And our state is following that recommendation. But of course, you can't just spot an unvaccinated person. Are there any plans for any kind of tracking or enforcement of this mandate for unvaccinated folks?
We don't have any plans for a state process through that. You know, like I said, any business is fully legally empowered to require to see proof of vaccination for their employees. If you're deciding on who, you know, wearing a mask or not, that's a business's right, and they have, you know, they should utilize that right should they choose. And we, like I said, we want folks to be mindful of who they're around, and obviously some people who are vaccinated are going to continue to wear masks, and that makes total sense. People are, you know, there's a spectrum, and we want people to feel safe, and it's important that we continue to enforce that we encourage people to get vaccinated. You know, it's not sort of, as we have to reframe the way we're thinking about it. We're not necessarily going back to normal, but we're moving forward.
Right.
So in that forward, some people are going to keep wearing masks, and that's a good thing.
You haven't flipped the big COVID restriction back to normal switch yet.
Well, we have today.
Yeah. Okay.
Today, we're,
but I
you
mean,
know, we're reopened again.
Not fully back to normal.
Well, it's more an awareness that we went through something, right?
Right.
We went through something that we can't just flip the switch and go back to normal.
Yes, exactly.
So we are reopening today. We're excited about that. Businesses are excited about that. People are excited about events and celebrating and enjoying our summer. But it is, you know, the awareness that we went through something very intense. And it's not going to be exactly the same as it was before, and we can still enjoy our lives while acknowledging that.
Absolutely. And I have a tweet from KK. He says he is concerned about all the children under 12 who do not have a vaccine yet. He says it's very dangerous for the little ones. Any idea when a vaccine will be available for children under 12?
That's a good question. You know, that one I would have to defer to sort of more national health experts, as I don't want to pretend to have qualifications on that front that I don't have. I know that there are trials in the works. I know, you know, everyone was really excited when Pfizer was approved for ages 12 to 16, and they were able to do that rather expediently, all things considered. And so I think they're working on, I think the age was the 5 to 12, but I could be a little bit off on that. Was the next phase that they were working on getting approved. And so fingers crossed, we're hoping to see one soon. You know, I agree. We want to make sure anyone can get a vaccine. We want to make sure that vaccines are available to everyone of every age. And We're going to, as soon as they are, we will absolutely let you know, and we'll roll out a brand new big push to get kiddos vaccinated and protected as well.
Now, according to the New Mexico Department of Health, we've got just about 29% of New Mexicans who still haven't gotten fully vaccinated. What is the plan to get those folks vaccinated?
Yeah, we're going to keep pushing those vaccines. Absolutely. We have the New Mexico Department of Health has a Trusted Voices campaign that they are employing all across the state. You know, the best way to encourage folks to get vaccinated, to make sure that they know that it is safe and that it is a good thing to do to protect themselves and their community, is using Trusted Voices from their own community. So we're employing that all across the state. We have a really impressive push of digital outreach and marketing investments. Make sure that everybody knows where vaccines are closest to them, that they're easy to get, that they're free, that they're safe. We also have the Vax to the Max lottery ongoing. So, you know, for your listeners, if anyone hasn't yet opted in, make sure you do. If you've been vaccinated, head to vaxtothemax.org and opt in. And if you haven't been fully vaccinated yet, make sure you go to vaccinenm.org. Schedule your first shot or schedule your follow-up shot if you already had your first one, and then head to vaxtothemax.org and opt in. And we did see a significant increase in vaccine signups after we announced the vaccine lottery. So those drawings are going to continue, and we are hopeful that they will continue to have a positive impact.
Now, of course, we are a very large state with a lot of rural areas. Many of the unvaccinated folks may simply not be able to get to a vaccination site. Are there plans for helping them with transportation or other forms of getting them their jabs?
Yeah, absolutely. So the department, I don't want to speak incorrectly, the Department of Health runs this, right? They would have all the nitty-gritty details on this. But if you head to vaccinenm.org, you will see all the vaccines all across the state near you. You can also call the state COVID hotline, and they can definitely help you connect you with more options. We have actually been employing mobile vaccination units from the very beginning of the campaign. So especially in southern parts of the state, they have really been making a really big difference. They've been going all across the state, all around the border as well. Just like you said, reaching folks who may not have transportation, who may not have broadband to register for a vaccine online. And it's all about bringing vaccines to the people, right? That was the idea as well with our central registration system for vaccines. Mm-hmm. It was the first of its kind in the country. Whereas in other states, we saw sort of a mad dash for people to get vaccines, people staying up all night to try and get codes on, you know, on websites that were made to do concert tickets. And we've been really focused on bringing the vaccines to the people, making sure they're accessible for all New Mexicans.
Is there another milestone marker, like we were looking for 60% of vaccinated folks before reopening? Is there anything else like that in the future?
I mean, I think every time I see that percentage of fully vaccinated New Mexicans inch up on the dashboard, it's a celebration for me. Every single vaccine that we administer is good news, each and every single one of them. That's another person protected from COVID. That's another, you know, and each vaccine has sort of a bubble of effect, right? Each person that's protected, that also protects people that they are spending time with, people around them. So every single one is exciting for me. You know, I think today is obviously a milestone. There's a lot of business owners and event spaces all across the state who have really, you know, they've really been through it this past year plus, and they really suffered. And the state has worked really hard to set up over $1 billion of financial support and assistance for those businesses. But I know they're excited to get back to opening today, and we're excited to see that.
Okay, we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. What are your thoughts on the reopening? Give us a call at 505-277-5866, and we will be back in a moment.
Support comes from PPC Solar, installing solar electric installations across New Mexico for over 40 years. PPC Solar provides grid-tie, off-grid energy storage and EV charging solutions for homes and businesses. More information at ppcsolar.com.
Support comes from REDW, an Albuquerque CPA and advisory firm founded in 1953 by New Mexicans for New Mexican businesses and individuals. Complete details about advisory and regulatory services at REDW.com.
Tristan Paradis says he doesn't play piano for the recognition. He plays simply because he loves the music.
When your heart is in it, it really does change the sound of the music.
Young artist in residence Tristan Paradis plays from the heart on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the end of COVID restrictions in New Mexico, at least for now. What sorts of things are you looking forward to doing now that these limitations on public gatherings are lifted? Give us a call at 277-5866 or tweet using hashtag #LetsTalkNM and tell us about it. Now, I'm going to bring in another guest now, Dr. Jagdish Khubchandani, a professor at New Mexico State University's Department of Health and the author of multiple studies examining vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jagdish.
Thank you for having me, Ty.
Certainly. Now, your studies looked at vaccine hesitancy in the general U.S. population. What defines vaccine hesitancy, first of all?
We have some confusion on that one, too. Many people say that it's refusal to take a vaccine, whereas some say it's also a wait-and-watch approach that should be included in hesitancy. For my studies, I go by anyone who says, I don't want the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So what were the factors that were most prevalent in vaccine-hesitant individuals, according to your study?
You know, in multiple studies, we find that there are two set of factors. One is a person's demographic background. It could be their age, race, gender. So in our studies, it's younger females, rural, with lesser education. And the second set of factors is psychological factors, concerns, fears, misinformation. And we found those to be plenty in our studies, too, also including the fact that if I'm not convinced that I could be infected or I feel I'm invincible, COVID could not affect me, then people think that they don't need the vaccine. So that's the problem here, that vaccine hesitancy becomes complicated because it's two set of factors. One is demographic and two is psychological. And each person has a unique identity on vaccine hesitancy.
So I know one of the studies showed that rates were particularly high among Black and Hispanic populations. Why is that particularly concerning?
No, multiple factors that lead to this situation with minority communities. Part of it was before the pandemic, they faced injustices in healthcare systems, so there's lack of trust. And now with the pandemic, there's more misinformation. What concerned me is that the high rates double the national average for African-Americans. Those are the individuals who have had more cases, more deaths, frequently engage in low-income frontline professions, and oftentimes not have access to health care. So a vulnerable population hesitant to vaccines is a recipe for greater death and disability.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nora, I wanted to ask you, is this the sort of thing that you guys are using in your outreach campaign? Do you have plans to, in particular, combat misinformation among specific populations in New Mexico?
Absolutely. That is something we've been doing with our with the Department of Health's Trusted Voices campaign, is specifically addressing those myths and parts of misinformation that have spread about vaccines in those conversations, in those videos, in that digital outreach. So we have folks who know firsthand, folks who people in the community can relate with, talking about those myths, addressing them directly, and getting people the right information, the real information, making sure that folks know that vaccines are safe, that they're effective, that they're free, and that they're easy to get.
Okay. And Jagdish, what were some of the other factors that you mentioned? You said a feeling of invincibility. That sounds like a tough one to combat. Do you have any thoughts as to how that could be addressed?
Yeah, you know, many of the people who are younger thought that the disease was only affecting the old people. That's how we started in the pandemic. It was predominantly a disease of the old and sick people. And so it could be that belief that I may not be getting infections or hospitalizations. The way to combat it is, you know, in our last study that is out for review, we show that if you know someone who has died, your vaccine hesitancy is reduced. So I think beyond emphasizing on the benefits of vaccines, we also have to tell people that if you don't get the vaccines, what is it that happens to your body? If you get infected, the long haul COVID. So in the next study we have a new approach that exposed people to the dangers of not having the vaccine.
Right. So how did that, what did that show?
That shows that, you know, people who have known someone who was hospitalized of COVID or died of COVID in the household, in the family, are less likely to decline a vaccine, whereas those who have never known someone who died of COVID are more likely to decline a vaccine. So I guess the idea is to show maybe images of lungs, facts, like the latest we have nationwide is that 99% of cases and deaths happen in unvaccinated people. So, you know, the calculation of risk and benefit has to be changed for a certain population in communication.
Are you still unvaccinated? Do you have questions about the safety of the vaccine or how you can sign up to receive it? Give us a call at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org, and one of our guests will help you out. Nora, I wanted to go back to you and ask a little bit more about this Trusted Voices campaign. Do you have any data that shows how effective it was?
So I would have to check with the Department of Health for that. I apologize. I don't know that off the top of my head. It's been their campaign that they've been running very successfully. But I'm happy to check with them on what their data is on that front. I did just want to add off of what the doctor said about, you know, young people, that's something really to consider in regards to the Delta variant. And, you know, if you're a young person who hasn't been vaccinated because you feel that that COVID won't be as bad for you, that's one thing we have seen with the Delta variant is that it is a lot more serious for young people than previous variants of COVID-19. So something to really take seriously, not play around with, not risk. Like the doctor said, almost all persons who are getting COVID and who are dying of COVID and who are seeing serious effects of COVID now are unvaccinated. So you should go ahead and head to vaccinenm.org and get vaccinated.
And is the state integrating studies like Jagdish's to take that data and use it to expand your efforts?
Definitely. You know, our state health experts are always looking at the most recent data. That's what all of our work has been based off of. And I'm sure you've heard Dr. Scrace talk about a multitude of studies every other week on their COVID-19 update. And they're always looking at what the latest information shows and what tools we can use from that to successfully get people vaccinated and protected from COVID.
Now, Jagdish, you also looked at hesitancy among healthcare workers. Now, one may assume that those rates were extremely low, but what did you actually find?
That didn't surprise me, but it does surprise many, especially that the study went into national media. The rates of vaccine hesitancy in healthcare workers are slightly lower than the general population. So 1 in 5 healthcare workers worldwide and nationwide do not want the vaccine or are trying to get the wait-and-watch approach. But again, you know, I've always believed that healthcare workers are not a monolithic group of people. From older doctors to younger females and support staff, you have a spectrum, and they are a part of the general population affected by similar kinds of misinformation and concerns and fears.
And did you see that there were certain reasons that came up again and again among this group as to why they were resisting or hesitant about taking the vaccine?
Yeah. So in our studies, we summarized, 75,000 healthcare workers around the world, and we dumped all the evidence that was available into one file. And we see that it was mostly concerns about side effects and safety. And then the enabling factors were being a male, being a doctor, being of older age, was the factor that was associated with highest vaccine acceptance. So it's almost like, you know, when you go beyond the doctor and the nurse, you have allied health support staff, many of them low-wage females, concerned about infertility and side effects, not being able to get a vaccine, or being scared about not being able to take care of family members if they get sick from the vaccine. And that reflects what we find in the general population.
Now, some of those concerns sound legitimate. I know many people did feel quite ill after getting their either first or second shot. And I wonder, are there social support programs that can help folks who get sick after getting their vaccine? Nora, is that anything that the state has considered looking into?
Sorry, can you say that one more time, Ty?
Sure. Well, Jagdish mentioned that one of the concerns among healthcare workers, especially among lower wage and female workers, was that they may get sick after getting their vaccination. And I know that certainly there were side effects from the vaccine. And so that's not necessarily a question of correcting misinformation, but rather assuring people that there may be some sort of assistance for them if they do get sick. Has the state looked into anything having to do with that kind of support?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that there is federal requirement for leave related to going and getting your vaccination. I don't want to speak out of turn and be incorrect on my nitty gritty details there, but that's a very fair point. You know, folks do experience some side effects from their vaccines. It's important that everybody knows that those are not a sign of somebody getting COVID. They are, in fact, a sign of your immune system registering the vaccine and getting to work, creating the antibody for the vaccine. It's a sign of the vaccine working and getting your body ready to be protected from COVID. So it's definitely one thing that we're looking at in a variety of things that we're looking at for vaccine hesitancy. And we're going to continue to, you know, all ideas remain on the table, even as we reopen, even as we continue moving forward to continue getting every eligible New Mexican vaccinated.
Okay. Now, Jagdish, based on your studies, do you have thoughts as to how New Mexico's vaccine outreach could be improved?
First, I want to thank the state, people of the state and the administration. I moved to New Mexico in June 2020, and I'm so proud, you know, because when you think of New Mexico from a distance in the field of public health, it happens to be a poor state, you know, sometimes lagging on the public health metrics. But the way we have handled this pandemic and the vaccination campaign is, you know, kudos to everyone. It's just a gem and a hidden gem in the nation. And we are among the top 10 states in the nation with vaccination campaign. Number of deaths, we are one of the lowest in the nation. I do think that, you know, New Mexico has some unique populations, you know, tribes and predominantly Hispanic, rural, lower education. And I think that the strategies put out are right on target. It may help if we continue the messaging weekly, biweekly, daily. I think the more we message, the better. As we said in our studies, it's about reducing complacency and constraints, building a sense of collective responsibility and communication for a local context. And I think the state is doing right what it should.
Okay, I have an email from John in Mountain Park, New Mexico. He says he lives in Otero County, which has a little over 30% of the population that is fully vaccinated, which is about half of the state average. He asks, shouldn't counties that have done such a poor job of vaccinating the public have some type of continued restrictions? Nora, is there any thought as to changing these restrictions on a county-by-county basis, going back to that system?
So it's something, you know, definitely counties are able to enact restrictions should they so choose. In fact, San Miguel County, where Las Vegas is located, actually implemented a mask mandate back in 2020 before the statewide mask mandate began. And they have really been incredible partners throughout the pandemic of keeping the people of San Miguel County safe and doing really incredible work to mitigate the spread of COVID. So that's just an example. You know, counties are definitely able to implement restrictions should they so choose. It's also something it highlights, you know, we really need local elected officials to encourage their community members to get vaccinated. We have the governor and state health officials doing it for the entire state, but we need partners in this, and we need local folks to come to the plate and encourage their community members to get vaccinated and point out the risks and the benefits and point out how important it is to keep people safe. And we continue to welcome that partnership with local partners, including in Otero County.
Okay. And I want to thank Jagdish Khubchandani for coming on today. We really appreciate your insights. And I know, Nora, you are also going to be having to leave. So thank you so much for being on today. Joining me now is Dr. Stephen Bradfute, Assistant Professor in the UNM Center for Global Health and Department of Internal Medicine. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Bradfute.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So this morning, we have been hearing a lot of questions from listeners about COVID variants. And of course, these have been dominating the news. First of all, what do people mean when we talk about a COVID variant, and how do they come to be?
That's a great question. So basically, a COVID variant is a set of mutations that cause one COVID virus or the SARS-CoV-2 virus to be different from another one. As the virus spreads throughout people, it accumulates mutations, and sometimes these mutations make the virus not as functional, and if that's the case, then those variants don't tend to spread. But sometimes a mutation will make the virus, for example, like the Delta variant, spread more easily. And so when that happens, that virus tends to outcompete whatever other viruses are around, and you get an emergent of this variant. So this happens with a lot of pathogens as they spread through any given population.
Now, as you mentioned, we have had quite a few variants by now, but the one that we're all talking about is the Delta variant. Why is this one getting all the headlines?
So, you know, we've been through a couple of variants already, which I think sometimes people may not have heard because it's not in the news as much. The original virus that came here with the first small wave was the original virus, and then that was supplanted by a different variant was a single change in the virus's spike protein that sticks on the surface of the cell. And then several months ago, that was overtaken by what is now called the Alpha variant, which is now still the dominant variant in the United States. And then the Delta variant is starting to probably supplant the Alpha variant, so that will be most likely the dominant virus in the United States as well as a lot of other places. What makes the Delta variant different from the Alpha variant is it's more infectious. And by that I mean that the virus spreads more easily amongst individuals, especially amongst individuals that are not vaccinated, than the Alpha variant. And this is probably due to some mutations in the virus that allow it to stick to your cells better and be more easily capable of infecting your cells.
So I have a question from Mary, who writes an email. She asks, do we know if available tests will catch the Delta variant?
It's a great question. So right now, the best way to detect the Delta variant is by sequencing. And so that's not a test that's rapidly available on demand, but there's a lot of groups that are doing it here at the University of New Mexico, also the state labs. Los Alamos National Labs is doing a lot of this analysis. So what tends to happen is these places will sequence the viruses that are coming in from patients, and that will tell you the frequency at which the virus is in the general population. But to my knowledge right now, there's not a specific test for Delta virus. It's just sort of an idea of whether or not what the dominant strains are in the area that you are.
And is the Delta variant in New Mexico at this point?
The Delta variant is in New Mexico. Right now, it is definitely not the dominant virus. It's still the Alpha variant. It's still the dominant one in New Mexico. It is expected that that's likely to change over the coming weeks and months, where the Delta variant will be most likely the dominant one. So it's here, but it's not the dominant one in the state right now.
And we have a call from Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. What is your question or comment for us today?
Well, my comment is when I was in line at the VA to receive my vaccination, both times thing is that my wife had to take me because it was a regulation that you had to have a driver take you in case you had a negative reaction. Now, when I took her, it required 2 times for me to go to the VA, and it required her 2 times to go to her doctor. So it was 4 trips. That makes it difficult for individuals. Now, since it was minimal negative reaction to the passenger, why not give the driver, now that we know there was a minimal negative reaction, why not give the driver shots too? That way, instead of giving 50% of the vaccination of the occupants of the car, now you're turning around and giving 100% vaccinations, doubling your effort. That is my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Dr. Brad Fuchs, I know that you are not involved necessarily in the state policy in how vaccinations are distributed, but I wonder, is there a way that we could be more efficient in getting these vaccines out, or is there a reason that we do it the way that we've been doing it that you're aware of?
You know, it's a great question, and I'd just be perfectly honest, that's kind of outside my area of expertise.
Sure.
I do know that, someone had mentioned earlier, the state's doing a great job with the vaccines. But I always think it's important to always reanalyze our efforts and try to make them more effective. So I think it's a perfectly valid question. It's just not something that I'm involved in, and so I really can't comment much on that.
Certainly. Well, given that 1/3 of people remain unvaccinated in the state, what does that mean in terms of the Delta variant? I know there's a surge going on right now in southern Missouri because of low vaccination rates and because the Delta variant is spreading. Do we expect it to take hold here among our unvaccinated population?
Yeah, it's something I really like to emphasize is that right now the vaccines, especially Pfizer and Moderna, we have data on that, and we're starting to get data from Johnson & Johnson. But the vaccines in the United States are very effective against the Delta variant. And even in the individuals that might get infected, if they're vaccinated with the Delta variant, they're more likely to be protected from severe disease. So the vaccine does work well against the Delta variant. If you're unvaccinated, because the Delta variant can spread more quickly, there's a higher chance of you getting infected with the Delta variant simply because it's more infectious. So if you're vaccinated, the early data suggests that it works very well against the Delta variant. If you're unvaccinated, I would encourage people, if they can, to get vaccinated. There's a lot of it's a lot easier access now, I think, than there used to be with going into pharmacies and things like that. So the vaccines right now are very effective against Delta. But if you're unvaccinated, it's a virus that's probably going to be easier to spread than the Alpha variant is.
Okay, it is time for a quick break. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. How are you honoring those we lost in the last year? There is still time to call in and tell us your story, 277-5866, or you can email us at letstalk@kunm.org.
Two Native Americans took home Pulitzer Prizes this year, and a third was a finalist. It's remarkable, since the last time a Native American won a Pulitzer Prize was Kiowa writer N. Scott Momaday for The Housemaid of Dawn in 1969. We'll talk with Pulitzer Prize winners and finalists on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Donations come in many forms, a sustaining membership, a one-time gift, even that extra vehicle you no longer need. Donating a vehicle is a great way to support KUNM. It's easy. Pickup is free, you get a tax deduction, a KUNM membership, and your vehicle could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Give us a call today to learn more about donating your vehicle. Call 888-KUNM-CAR, that's 888-586-6227. And thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm speaking to Dr. Stephen Brad Fuchs, Assistant Professor at the UNM Center for Global Health. Dr. Bradfute, we were just speaking about vaccines and how they are still effective against the Delta variant. We all know, of course, that we have to get a new flu shot every year to protect against the latest variation of the flu virus. Is there going to be a point where we need a new COVID vaccine to protect us against its latest mutation?
It's a great question, and I can say that that's still an open question. There was some early evidence that it looked like people were going to need to get booster shots regardless of the variant. And then there's some newer data suggesting the vaccines might still be potent longer than we originally thought. So it's something that's still open for discussion. And I think there's clinical trials going on right now where they are boosting people that have been vaccinated against the original strain variant are now being boosted with vaccines against different variants. So that data will come out soon. I think it's just a bit early to tell one way or another.
And it looks like we have a call from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen. What is your question or comment?
Good morning. So here's my question. There are many New Mexicans who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and everything I'm reading is saying that it is not as effective against the Delta variant as Moderna and Pfizer. So what can New Mexicans do who were just randomly given the Johnson & Johnson to better protect themselves? Can they get now a Pfizer shot? And how do you go about doing that?
Okay, thank you, Ellen. Dr. Bradfute, is that the case that that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is less effective against the Delta variant?
So there's been more research done on Pfizer and Moderna right now than Johnson & Johnson. I think the important thing to remember is that the vaccines, from what we know, even if they're not as necessarily effective at stopping people from getting infected, they're still quite protective. And then they're very protective, even if they're not as protective of you getting infected, they're very protective against getting very sick, hospitalized, or death. So there are some ongoing studies to see if individuals that have one vaccine can get a boost with a different vaccine. Some of the early data suggest that's very possible. So I think that is a possibility in the future, but those clinical trials are still being conducted. So that's the data right now. I wish I could give a more definitive answer, but we're still waiting on those studies to be completed.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Bradfute. Like to welcome our next guest, Jeanette Nunez del Prado. She is a volunteer with COVID Survivors for Change and a licensed clinical social worker. Good morning, Jeanette. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me and including voices like mine in this important conversation.
Certainly. Now, I know that this has been a hard few months for you. You lost your father to COVID in May, and I'm so sorry about that. Could you talk a little bit about when people learn that your father died of COVID, do you know if that's helped people who may have been skeptical about the gravity of the virus? Is that something that you've noticed in your conversations?
Yes, I think so. Often they're surprised to hear, you know, that he was only 62, no pre-existing conditions, healthy. Often the questions are, why did he have pre-existing conditions? You know, why wasn't he vaccinated? Just a lot of, seeking reassurance that it couldn't happen to them. So I think so. And I think knowing someone and hearing my experience also helps to build some empathy for them and not wanting to ever go through what I'm going through.
Now, Jeanette, I wonder if you could maybe, it seems like maybe you're a little far from the phone. We're having some trouble with the volume. Is there a way that maybe you could be closer to the receiver?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
I think that's a bit better, yes.
Okay.
So could you tell me how you're feeling about the state ending COVID restrictions at this point?
Sure. I mean, I feel a range of emotions. There's a part of me that's, proud to see the progress our community's made in fighting COVID. It's been nice to do things like have coffee with friends I haven't seen in a long time or go for walks in my neighborhood with our kids and see our neighbors' smiling faces. But at the same time, I see that there's this collective feeling of joy in the community and celebration, and there isn't any large-scale acknowledgement of the people that we lost and what mourners are experiencing. And it just leaves me and a lot of us feeling that our grief is unacknowledged, our loved ones aren't being honored, and, you know, we're not celebrating right now. We're still hurting and grieving. You know, we can't just go back to normal. We're changed forever.
Now, you're advocating for a permanent memorial to those we have lost over the last year due to COVID. Can you tell me about that and why you feel it's important to continue to honor those folks going forward?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think in order to understand the importance of a memorial, it could help to just understand what a COVID loss looks like. Would it be okay for me to talk a little bit about that?
Certainly.
Okay. I mean, so for my dad, losing him was just devastating. We weren't able to be with him in the hospital when he was sick. You know, we couldn't hold his hands. We couldn't say goodbye. We couldn't have a funeral. And because of this, it doesn't feel like he died. It feels like he just vanished.
Yes.
And I've connected to a lot of people in the community that have lost family to COVID. And the things that I'm feeling are just so common. Like, anytime you lose a loved one, it's hard.
Right.
But losing someone to COVID is unique in the devastation. And it can really interfere with the natural grieving process. You can just feel stuck, like your grief is just suspended and you don't have any closure. And it can become complicated and prolonged and unresolved and even traumatic for a lot of people. So I think, you know, just understanding that, it can help build people's understanding for the need for a permanent memorial in our state. You know, because we couldn't gather for a funeral, which, you know, everyone knows that this is just, it's a natural and healing ritual for grief that we do. I feel that we need a physical place to go and to mourn and to celebrate life, and to have connection to other grievers. I know, you know, one of the hosts or one of the guests talked about moving forward, and I don't think we can truly move forward in a healthy way together unless we can honor those we've left behind and those that are still suffering from the aftermath of the pandemic.
Now, you mentioned a physical space as being particularly important to this idea of being able to share grieving. Do you have a place in mind for where this memorial could go in New Mexico?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's so important for us to get together, for people like me to get together, stakeholders and the politicians to come up with the best idea for our community. But what I imagine is somewhere in a central location, maybe in Old Town, hopefully in Albuquerque, since it is the most, you know, populous area and it could benefit the most people. And, you know, it could be there's other kind of models of these types of memorials, like the Vietnam Wall. You know, but the tragic thing is COVID isn't over. So if we wrote the names of our loved ones, we would have to leave space to keep adding names. And that could be hard. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, but it can be hard. I'm imagining, you know, a beautiful statue. We could have a call out to local artists and give preference to artists that have lost someone to COVID, and you know, they might be able to convey through art what words just can't capture, just the depth of the loss.
Yeah. I understand that you've reached out to the state about this project. What have you heard back from them?
Unfortunately, nothing. And, you know, I don't take that as a lack of interest, because I know, you know, we've been a leader in fighting COVID and believing that it's real and protecting the most vulnerable amongst us. I see it as a lack of priority, because I know there's a lot going on with the state reopening. But I think it should be a priority. I mean, we can't move forward without acknowledging just the loss and the pain. I mean, we can't expect people to go back to work and, you know, put on our work pants and go be productive when we're feeling this way. You know, it's just, it's an unhealthy way of moving on without, you know, without acknowledging the pain and acknowledging what we've lost.
And what do you think our listeners should keep in mind as we enter this? We're not at quite at the end of the pandemic, as you mentioned, but this new phase of the pandemic.
I mean, I think I just want to echo what everyone has said about the importance of vaccinations, if not for you, for your loved ones. I mean, don't say all this. He didn't have access to the vaccine, and it would have saved him. And we never thought he could die from COVID. You know, he was only 62. He was strong. Before the pandemic hit, he played tennis every day. And he ran a 5K with my younger sister. He was a fun, lively person, so full of life. He was not ready to go, and we were not ready for him to leave us.
I know this is hard to talk about, but I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this. I think it's so important that we are able to realize exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about as we move forward and how important it is to not just believe that we're entering the return to normal world. So I really appreciate you coming on and talking about that. If people are interested in learning more about this memorial, is there a place that they can go to learn?
Yes, my group, COVID Survivors for Change, you can go on there and learn about our efforts to, you know, memorialize. And there's two opportunities that are coming up to show support for people like me that are mourning and helping us to feel acknowledged and our loved ones not forgotten. The first one is, you know, this 4th of July, as we come together, a lot of us will be coming together for the first time with friends and family, and, you know, there will be some empty chairs. And we want to, you know, acknowledge that. So we have a kind of a fun and simple campaign to be in, and it's Add Yellow, hashtag Add Yellow. Yellow is the color of COVID remembrance. And so just taking pictures, adding yellow to your celebration, posting them to social media with the hashtag Add Yellow. It's just, you know, a simple and powerful act of showing solidarity to support me and others like me. And we have a march coming up, too, in August, August 14th at T-Wes Park at 10 a.m. And, it's just a family-friendly event where we'll have people coming together, marching around the track to remember those we lost to COVID and also those that are living with long COVID. You know, we wanted to do it at a park with a short area to march because a lot of them can't march long distances. They get winded, and, you know, they need to be included and recognized and supported as well.
And thank you so much for joining us today, Janet. The information that Jeanette was sharing is available on our website, so you can check that out, KUNM.org. Look for the article about today's show. That is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Nora Sackett, Dr. Jagdish Kubchandani, Dr. Stephen Bradfute, Jeanette Nunez del Prado. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Also, tune in Sunday morning at 11 for No More Normal, where we'll continue exploring what this reopening means for all of us and how we can grieve for those we've lost. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Zaylee Pollan screened your calls. Megan Kamrick produced the show, and Robert Maldonado live tweeted. I'm your host and executive producer, Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.